uncharacteristically, Ryanair and Uber have both been in grovelling apology mode. We look at the latest sagas affecting the transport companies. We also look at property and the boring budget in October. You're listening to The Post Podcast with me, Francesca Cumann. And you're very welcome to The Post Podcast with myself, Francesca Cumann, standing in for Ian Guider. In a while, our political correspondent Hugh O'Connell will be joining us to talk steady as she goes budgets and the politics behind the property tax. But first, we're going to look at two companies we love to hate, Ryanair and Uber. I'd like to welcome my guests in the studio with me, our business correspondent Jack Corgan-Jones and broadcaster Jonathan Healy.
How you doing, Francesca?
Hey, Francesca.
If there's one thing we've seen in the last week is that it's not always easy delivering low-price, convenient transport. Just ask Ryanair's Michael O'Leary and Uber's Dara Khosrowshahi. Uncharacteristically, both have been in grovelling apology mode. Uber, after its taxi service was banned from operating in London, and Michael O'Leary, well, he's been described as Icarus and the man who fell to earth. Jack, is there some schadenfreude, do you think, or some sort of business karma going on for Michael O'Leary in the way this is being reported?
Ah, yeah, for sure. I mean, look, there is a certain element of this, which is just people loving seeing Ryanair failing. So we have to kind of disaggregate that, because anyone who's ever had a bag lost or a flight turn up late or been nauseated by the trumpet sound or whatever loves to see Ryanair not doing well. But there is a really serious business story underneath this, because for Ryanair, there's never been such a thing as bad news, right? It's always been the company that no matter how badly it has screwed someone over, no matter how hilarious it is cocked up, it's always just had a cheeky, chappy attitude towards it and said, well, you know, you get what you pay for and we get you there in the end, so what are you going to do about it? That's the Ryanair kind of modus operandi. But the dysfunction and the problems they've had over the last week and a half speak to something more profound, and it's a challenge that they've never really had to focus, or they've never had to face before, right? Because pilot rosters, losing pilots to other companies, rearranging year-end date, these are complex, intricate, logistical tasks, but they're exactly the kind of tasks that people are paid really well to get right. And I think that's why we've seen a corresponding impact on the share price, because it's not just another normal Ryanair bad news story. It's a story which perhaps speaks to an inability at the airline's highest levels to handle really complex issues, which are really important if you're going to run a successful airline. It's a difficult business.
And very important, Jonathan, for their particular business model. As you said, it's a failure of their own model.
And look, what's really interesting to watch in all of this is the numbers. I mean, we're talking about 2%. It's a very small number of their overall flights, most of which operated as normal. But then again, you have 189 people are there or thereabouts on each of those flights who have the ability to post about it on social media, to tell people how discommoded and how disrupted they have been. And, you know, for a long time, Michael O'Leary was held up there as the guy, oh, let's let him run the health service. Let's let him get into government. And it turns out that he's as fallible as public bodies themselves. The fact that unions are now hovering is Michael O'Leary's worst nightmare. Hmm. The idea that there's 350 pilots that are being approached by IALPA in Dublin alone. In Italy, they're looking to bring pilots into the union. Ryanair doesn't want to have anything to do with unions. I mean, Jack, you're probably too young to remember the baggage handler strike at Dublin Airport that involved Ryanair many, many moons ago. But, you know, Ryanair saw them off. Can they see them off this time around? I mean, there was this reported memo that said, pilots, we have them on their knees. And it's hard to disagree with that analysis. How can Ryanair come out of this without appeasing what is a group who are already disaffected?
I agree entirely. Like, I mean, now the pilots, for the first time in the grand history of Ryanair, they have the whip hand. Like, the Ryanair model has always been based on not really needing, like, your ABC1 or your Tier 1 passengers. Rich people don't really fly Ryanair because they don't have to. And that never really mattered, because there's always been more people who would go for the affordable option. There's always been more middle income and poor people who would fly Ryanair. The problem is with pilots, they haven't been able to hold on to those ABC1 and Tier 1 pilots, and there's not that massive reserve. There's not an equivalent to, like, you know, your middle income and poor people in the pilot class, you know? So they now have this issue where they don't have experienced pilots. They don't have people who can fly the newer class of planes as much. And these kind of people are proving very attractive to other airlines, and they're losing them.
If you're a Ryanair pilot, so you're on a 737 shuttling backwards and forwards, now you can work with Norwegian. And what have Norwegian done? Norwegian have just launched transatlantic flights. So pretty much the same aircraft, 737-8 or 737 MAX, translatable skill. You can fly in, you can say you're flying into Boston, you're flying into New York. Ryanair never had that challenge. They had a pilot grouping that they took advantage of the fact that pilots loved what they were doing and there were limited opportunities. Now that the industry is picking up, those opportunities have expanded. So you can understand why they're willing to move.
Yeah, and compounding all that as well, I mean, pilots kind of love themselves, right? I mean, it's something that O'Leary has pointed out, and he's not wrong. You know, the peaked cap, you know, the aviator sunglasses and all this stuff. They have a lot of pride in what they do, and they have a lot of pride in themselves. And the way that O'Leary talks about them, you know, as glorified taxi drivers, as people whose job isn't really that difficult, that is now coming back to bite him in the ass. Yeah, exactly, because he's reaping what he sows. They're saying, right, now we have the upper hand. Now we have the power. We'll either leave or you improve the conditions. And by the way, we're not particularly pleased with the way you've talked about us over the last, you know, 10 years or so. So now we're going to make you squirm as well. It's a very unfamiliar position for Ryanair, very unfamiliar position for O'Leary.
Pilots are obviously in a different category than a lot of other Ryanair staff in terms of that they are more protected in their terms and conditions. So what is actually the root of their gripes, given that they must be paid a certain amount, they must only work certain hours? You know, I mean, safety issues are coming to the fore. They definitely are more protected, say, than cabin crew, who'd be very much, hired. They're not even directly hired. They'd be agency staff.
I think it's the fact that they're rather pivotal to the operation. And if they decide that they can collectively negotiate, and they did that. I mean, there's been a history of issues, but there's been a history of it's not quite collective bargaining, but union, the pilots would have come together to represent other pilots to get a deal with Ryanair. The problem is that, you know, now the expectation is that they want more. I mean, there was a story last week, and of course, this is the kind of thing that comes out when you're in industrial dispute, that there were a couple of staff, I think it was East Midlands Airport, and they were told, well, you're transferring to another airport, I think it was somewhere in Germany, and if you don't do that, well, you're not getting paid, right, and we're not getting rid of you, so you have to take unpaid leave. And that is very sharp practice.
There was an issue, I think, as well with costs. Yes, you can move over to that airport, but you have to pay for your own costs.
And again, in the industry, in the aviation industry, that is unheard of. You won't hear of other airlines doing that. So if O'Leary manages to get the pilots in line, then he'll have to deal with cabin crew. Mm. Then he'll have to deal with all the other people who work for Ryanair. I mean, they use agency, most other airports, they use agents, so ground handling agents, don't have to worry about them. But anyone in-house, he is going to have to worry about, because there's a trickle-down effect here, and people who have been in the long grass waiting a long time are finding that now is a good time to emerge.
If they found their voice. I suppose I want to go on to the other story there I was flagging up at the beginning, and that's the Uber row. Well, it's always sort of bubbling away in the background. But again, we have this kind of notion of a sort of market interrupter coming in and trying to do things differently. And it's sort of blown up in the face of Uber, certainly in London. Jack, can you just kind of talk what's going there?
Yeah, they have a lot in common with Ryanair in some ways, because they've had this kind of interloper upstart attitude, you know, two fingers to regulators, and we're here to bring down costs for consumers, and that's our business model. And if it annoys people, if it annoys entrenched elites or regulators or any of these kind of tired cliches that we're used to hearing out of the mouth of Michael O'Leary, we don't care, right? And that's all well and good until a regulator turns around and says, well, we think you've sailed too close to the wind here. We're revoking your license to operate. And it's even worse if that regulator is in one of the largest cities in Western Europe and one of the most important cities when it comes to finance and politics and all that good stuff, London. That's happened. Mm. They've lost their license to operate in London. And now the company is in a bit of a tailspin because they're not really quite sure how to react. They've just gone through a change at the top. The CEO was shoved out after a series of scandals. And now it's up to the new CEO to try and figure out the best way to navigate the way forward, which might actually result in them being able to hang around in London.
Apart from the kind of the bad marketing and advertising all this is bringing on the company, I mean, it sounds like the issue in London relates to reporting of, it's basically background checks on drivers, reporting crime.
It's what you would consider basic in an industry like this. And the point is that Uber were the disruptors to the traditional taxi sector. And now what Transport for London and Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London, has done is that he has disrupted that disruption. So we're kind of in a virtuous circle here. Uber on paper was bonkers. They didn't conform to exactly the same regulations that were very strictly in place for taxis. The problems they ran into were particularly in relation to very serious stuff like sexual assaults not being reported. So therefore, drivers being out there who were under suspicion or who were being investigated or maybe who weren't being investigated because it wasn't being reported.
Again, Jack wouldn't remember, but we had sort of issues like this back in the 90s. Sorry, Jack.
How do you pronounce that? 90s?
Well, we did with Hackney's. Yeah. And what happened was the industry was much more tightly regulated, over-regulated. Many taxi drivers would argue if they're listening to this now. But at least we have a properly functioning system to the point at which Uber, it's not worth your while to being an Uber driver in this country because you might as well be a taxi driver. There was something inherently wrong about just rocking up and saying, hi, I'm a taxi, when you've not gone through all the checks that need to be done. So I think that this is good. This is going to make them drag their socks up. But they're not gone. They're still around. You can hail an Uber right now in London, and they're going to be here probably, I think, read somewhere about 2 years before the appeal process exhausted.
Look, as Jono says, the real problem for Uber here is that what they've been charged with goes right to the core of a lot of people's fears about the Uber platform, that you're just not necessarily as safe in an Uber as you will be in a taxi, and that's why it's going to be a real problem for them on top of just losing the license. You know, there's a fear amongst people there, and these allegations won't do anything to dispel that fear. What's interesting as well is how the company has reacted. Right, so the previous CEO, a guy called Travis Kalanick, was renowned for his
nice guy.
Yeah.
Very nice guy.
Renowned for his, shall
his
we say,
own taxi experiences.
abrasive attitude might be the kindest way of putting it. You know, he was very much of the two fingers school. You know, I don't care. I'm here to disrupt. And if you're not ready to be disrupted, that's your problem, not mine. So that didn't transpire. That didn't work out very well for him. He lost his job. So now the new CEO, Derek Khosrowshahi, has adopted nearly the exact opposite approach here, in that he's gone out and said, we are sorry. That's the first thing they've done off the bat. They've said, look, we apologise to the people of London, we apologise to Londoners, and we ask for their support in this difficult time for Uber, because they will be going into a scrap with TfL, with Transport for London, to see if they actually are able to hold on to that license.
A meeting with Sadiq Khan, all this.
Yeah, what's interesting is happening underneath that, right? So underneath that headline apology, they're actually disputing nearly every charge that's been put their direction by T4L. So that's the direction I think we should be ready to go.
But having said that, just reading what they said, they said that at the time, and hindsight is great, at the time they believed that it should be down to victims whether to report crimes to police, and that it did not routinely report incidents retrospectively to police on behalf of others. So therefore, the victim, hey victim, if you didn't do it yourself, then it's not up to us to do it. We just have a guy who may have assaulted you who's driving around in a taxi. I mean, it's bonkers. And it has to go to the core of what appeared to be quite a weird organisation that was very toxically male.
I feel very shielded from Uber. I know people talk about it all the time, but in Ireland, I find it's a business model that has very little appeal or interest to me, but I don't think I'm alone because of our taxi laws.
I mean, look, the Uber works by increasing the pool of people who could be taxi drivers. That's why it's been so massively successful in the US, because you or Jono or anyone could turn around and just download the app and say, hey, I'm a taxi driver. Right, that doesn't work in Ireland here, because the National Transport Authority very tightly controls who gets a public service vehicle license. You can't just download an app and become a taxi man. You have to go through a huge vetting process, and actually they're not handing out the plates anymore. So realistically, they haven't been able to expand that pool of potential drivers. Therefore, the business model hasn't really worked
as
well.
It's retracting. The number of taxi drivers is actually retreating now, because people are, you know, they drove taxis because they couldn't find other work. Now they've found other work, so that's why it's becoming harder and harder to get a taxi when you want to get one.
The business model here, it's quite difficult, I assume, for Uber to really crack the market. And I suppose the good news for customers is that it is regulated here. If you do go the Uber route, you don't have any.
It is. And look, what's interesting is they've tried to figure out different workarounds here. They've proposed to the Department of Transport that perhaps in Limerick they should be allowed a pilot project where they can do this ride sharing, this technology where you can just download the app and become a taxi man. Not unsurprisingly, this was shortly after they announced several hundred jobs for Limerick. The two may not be unconnected. But the Department of Transport effectively turned around and said no chance. Okay. When we redrew the taxi driver regulations in 2013, we've no interest in revisiting them yet.
I don't think we're any the worse off for not having Uber here. I think, you know, we still get around the place. We don't need that kind of disruption. The market is already well served. London's a bigger city, bigger place, much more restrictions on the number of black cabs in particular. So maybe there's a market. I don't think we don't want them. We don't need them yet. They are.
Yeah, let me play devil's advocate with that for a second, right? I mean, we're thinking of Uber as, you know, just another taxi technology. And the way the company would present this themselves, and I don't think it's entirely without foundation, is that they're actually fundamentally changing the way people transport themselves around cities. That, you know, if Uber is allowed to penetrate more highly, there'd be lower car ownership, there'd be more efficient use of public service or public transport because people can transport themselves between hubs and stuff like that. And then in a rural setting, you know, people might be able to go to the pub a bit more and avoid the whole drink driving problem as well. So it's not just that they're an exactly similar another taxi operation. That's just my little bit of devil's advocate.
Isn't
there.
Jonathan right to the extent, though, I don't know, but my experience of being in London is, okay, expensive black cab, or you have to ring a Hackney for it to come to you.
Life in your hands.
I mean, this might be
a few
years. Yeah, but it was a big cost difference. Whereas here we can always flag down cabs. They're all the same rate. You don't have that kind of competing black cab, Hackney cost difference. And then apps, suddenly you had a smartphone app, which we have here obviously as well, but it kind of changed the dynamic because instead of hanging around waiting, you could really get one based on location very quickly.
Yeah, and the nice thing for us was we still have all these app options available to us, but we do have a kind of predictability in terms of vetting of drivers and how much it's going to cost us. You know, we don't like every single fare, no matter whether it's an Uber, Halo or My Taxi, or just someone you get in the street, has to be determined by the same taxi meter. So there's this kind of predictability there that I think people are actually probably going to appreciate a little bit more when they see the kind of the tumult that's going on in other jurisdictions.
Wait until we get the robot cars, then things will really kick off.
Anyway, both men doing a bit of humble pie this week. I'll leave it there. Thank you very much, Jack and Jonathan. In today's busy world, the Business Post prides itself in quality independent journalism. We provide trusted comment and analysis on the stories that matter. Our award-winning journalists provide in-depth insights on our 7-day digital offering across a mobile responsive website, apps and e-paper. Subscribe today and gain immediate access to a trusted news source. Welcome back. You're listening to the Post podcast. I'm now joined by Hugh O'Connell. We've kept Jonathan in the studio.
I tried to leave, but they wouldn't let me.
No, I insisted. His car meter, he's got another 15 minutes, so he has to stay. Hugh, we're going to have a look at the whole issue of property tax. It's been bubbling away in the background. In fact, everyone is quite happily, well, homeowners have been probably quite happily keeping their heads in the sand, just hoping everything's going to stay the same. And hurrah. Seems to be.
Yeah, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar to the rescue once again for the middle classes. He was in London yesterday where he was asked about this, and he indicated that he'd be looking at some sort of freeze, perhaps, of property tax in 2019. You'll remember, listeners may remember, that when the property tax was introduced, it was actually very controversial, but gradually it's sort of become part of the normal.
And they got revenue involved.
They got revenue involved, yeah.
Of revenue, so
everyone kind of decided, right, we'll go along with this, we better pay this, or otherwise the revenue will come after it. So people have been paying their property tax based on the valuation of their property back at the end of 2013. Now, we're all aware...
But it was worth tenpence. Everyone's house was worth tenpence.
We're all aware that everyone's house back in 2013 was probably worth a lot less than it is now. So the fear is, and there was a freeze put in place for 4 years, and the fear is that when we get to 2019, when property tax rates are due to be examined again, that there's going to be a huge hike in people's property tax rate and the amount that they have to pay because of the soaring value of property across the country. Property, I think, is going up by about €500 a month or something crazy like that.
Yeah, that's right. That's what it was. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So, but the Taoiseach to the rescue. And he has said that they will fight might and main to ensure that the tax burden on people isn't that burdensome, I suppose, come 2019.
So it's essentially a stay of execution so we can all bury our heads in the sand again for a little while. But I suppose when 2019 comes, are we all going to be in for a shock, or is there any other kind of hint of what's...
This is nothing more than blatant electioneering, as far as I can see. That Leo Varadkar knows that he's going to have
to... Are you kidding?
Leo Varadkar is going to go to the people at some stage in the next 12 months, and he wants to stockpile as much as he can of things that he has promised and will be able to stand over if he gets re-elected. the natural conclusion is the property tax has to go up. There's no point in having a tax if it isn't kept in line with what the conditions of the market are. So therefore, we should all be paying more in property tax when our property prices go up. If he's trying to put an artificial cap on it now, it's very convenient because all the other political parties will have to do the same. Fianna Fáil aren't going to hike this. Sinn Féin most certainly are not going to hike this.
They want to get rid of it still.
They want to exactly. Yeah. So that mean that there is a political expedience to this. And as we'll talk about in a minute, they don't have an awful lot of else to play with, particularly for that middle class that Fine Gael are courting so desperately. They're not going to get much out of the budget apart from the price of a pint. So therefore, this is a good way of saying, hey, guys, Fine Gael, you know, that property tax we introduced, we're good for that.
Yeah.
One of the interesting elements of this is that property tax is supposed to be go towards local services and paid to local authorities. Now, local authorities have the discretion to either reduce property tax by 15% or increase it by 15%. Now, most of them around the country have, of course, reduced it. And they've just, councils around the country have just voted in either maintaining 15% reductions. In some cases, I think in Kerry they increased it by 5%, and that's to that takes account of the increasing burden on local authorities financially. And then there's another issue which the Fine Gael TD Josefa Madigan has been talking about recently, not without controversy, of some instances where people in Dublin, for example, pay a lot of property tax, and there's a lot of money that goes into Dublin City Council and the other Dublin local authorities. But then you have areas like Roscommon that require a top-up of the amount of property tax
from
that
central,
their local authority takes in. I think it's called the Property Tax Equalisation Fund. And there's a bit of resentment, I suppose, lingering there that Dublin householders are having to pay for services in Roscommon. So that's an issue, but it will remain an issue indefinitely because ultimately there are a lot more people living in Dublin and paying property tax.
But the frustration, there's an obvious disconnect there as well, because local authorities, by reducing the amount they bring in property tax, that means they have less money to spend on vital services. And who is
homelessness
charged
being
with
one of them, right?
the biggest crisis right now is homelessness. And Dublin City Council, and I'm not sure about the other three councils in Dublin, but they have an opportunity to get more cash in to deal with that. But again, because of political expedience, they're not doing it. So there's a number of actors on the field here. Mm. But at the same time, we don't know who ultimately is going to see more coming out of their pockets, because the local authorities have one say and the councillors have another say, central government have another say. Again, it's a classic Irish lack of leadership on a single issue.
Well, local authorities don't seem to have much of an incentive though, do they? Because they say it just is in exchange of central funding. So it's not like they can kind of rub their hands with glee. The more they pull in, the more they lose, they probably feel, right from the exchequer, or that seems to be it. So there's no incentive for them to go crazy on it, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the other things that Taoiseach spoke about during his leadership campaign was that ultimately local authorities would have full discretion over the property tax, that they could set the rates that they want and that they could keep all the money. This created a bit of concern in areas like Roscommon, for example, that they would lose out because there wouldn't be this centralisation fund. Now, I think that there's still the plan to maintain that kind of central fund to top up.
But they have to, because otherwise
authorities.
They won't have.
Yeah, they do. But Jonathan's right. Like, there's total political expediency around this issue. Fianna Fáil, I think, has written. Barry Cowan has written to all the Fianna Fáil councillors to basically say, don't hike property tax as it's coming up for review over the next few weeks and over the last few weeks, which is completely inconsistent, I would have thought, with Fianna Fáil's position that local authorities need to be building more social housing, for example. And where are they going to get the money for that?
Yeah.
You know?
Want to move on to more budgetary matters. Hugh, you're saying this is going to be a boring budget, and you say it as if that's a bad thing, but surely maybe it is for journalists. Maybe it's a bit of a disaster.
No, I'm not.
But, you
I'm
know,
grand. Like, you know, having
really
to chase around budget
October.
Stories this year, I'm not too fussed. Look, there's no money, and when there's no money, when there's no money to cut, as there was during the austerity budgets of the late noughties and early 2010s, there's no kind of, you know, debate around, oh, what's going to be cut, what's under threat. And equally, when there's no money to spend, as there is this year, there's no debate around, well, what are the kind of sweeteners we're going to get in the budget. So the big row, if it even is a row, and it's not really a row, it's a phony row, is Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil deciding how they're going to cut tax by 2 or 3 cents, or sorry, 2 or 3 euro a week for for middle-income earners, which is just pathetically.
Yeah, I miss the kite flying. This used to be kite flying season. Yeah, you couldn't move in Dublin too without seeing kites being flown on various different issues. It's the status quo budget. I don't know, maybe Pascal Donoghue could walk in to the music of status quo, because that's all it's going to be. It's going to be the same steady as you were. You have a little bit more money in your pocket. But that's it. There's nothing more. And you feel sorry for Pascal Donoghue, because you know, he's been pretender to the throne for so long. Yeah. Now that he's there, he's got nothing to do.
Now, theoretically, he does have he'll have more wiggle room next year. We're going to deliver a balanced budget this year, which is why perhaps there's so little to spend.
Well, is there not a debate there about the very fact that you would bother giving such a pathetic incentive to the middle classes when there are more pressing matters for spending?
This is, we are in the era of strategic communication. We will be given a five-year plan.
Yeah,
of
exactly.
All the fantastic things they're going to do in 2 or 3 years' time, bear with us, folks. It's like a construction project.
So why bother throw a few coins?
Well, they have to throw something, because if they don't throw anything, that's worse. I mean, Hugh was right. This is a boring budget, but we need boring budgets. I mean, there was a time when we were having two budgets a year, and it was extremely stressful for everybody because it was austerity. There is something to celebrate in the normalcy of this, that, you know, we are no longer worried about who is going to get screwed more. We know now that none of us are going to necessarily get screwed, but none of us are going to benefit. And I think that that is, after the decade that we have been through, that's almost something to be celebrated.
Lack of ambition?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, as Jonathan said, there'll be probably some sort of kind of 3 or 4 year budgetary plan announced on October the 10th, which will have your minor tax cuts, pathetic tax cuts almost, for next year. But then you'll have you'll have a lot of talk around capital investment over the next 4 or 5 years, and then you'll have a kind of a plan towards reducing the personal income tax burden on the middle classes again, out to kind of 2019, 2020, and so on. So that'll be where, I suppose, the strategic communications unit and the spin element of this government will come into effect. And of course, like, the idea that we can project forward to 2020 and say, well, we'll be able to put income tax at this rate, or USC at this rate, or we will be able to merge PRSI and USC, is folly, really, when you consider the political instability that exists in the country right now, and that will probably exist for many years to come. The poll, the one in our paper at the weekend, didn't show a huge difference from what the parties were at in the last general election. Now, both Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil are up, and there's some consolidation around those two parties, which you know, the government will take, and Fianna Fáil will take great pleasure from, because it means, you know, this old idea of the centre is holding. But they won't be in a position, either of them, to form a majority government, and the other smaller parties are still, you know, not, the Labour haven't recovered at all. They're down, in fact, and Sinn Féin, no one seems to want to do business with them. So, you know, there's too much instability in the political system at the moment, and too much instability internationally, I think, to be able to say definitively that whatever is announced on October the 10th will actually happen come 2019, 2020.
But in the meantime, they're at least trying to project steady as she goes. We'll leave it there. I can see Jonathan looking very anxiously at his phone.
It's the parking is up now,
parking.
You see.
Yeah. And that's it for this week's Post podcast. A big thank you to my guests, Jack Organ-Jones, Hugh O'Connell and Jonathan Healy. Also, thanks to our editor, Jack O'Kennedy.